The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Elliot Funtenschell is the guest this week, and we discuss his novel Zen City, which was published by Zero Books back in June. The book received a starred review in Publishers Weekly. They said, "Zen City succeeds brilliantly, deftly weaving a tragic romance that's about all of us and none at all." It's Thursday, September 29th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. But before we begin the podcast, I want to thank Tom B., Nick M., Manuel K., and Paul C. for becoming Zero Books Club members. Members gain access to our new Inside Zero Books podcast. Members are also invited to participate in bi-monthly online workshops in critical theory and philosophy. Our first workshop will feature Daniel Coffeen and his book, Reading the Way of Things. Members get access to audiobooks from our Advancing Conversations book series on a quarterly basis. Finally, members receive occasional promotional discounts on selected Zero Books titles. This episode on Zen City includes an explanation of Zen from Alan Watts, along with some instructions on how to ride a bicycle. The music you're listening to right now is Stereolab's Fried Monkey Eggs. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Elliot Funtenschell describe life in Zen City. Elliot Funtenschell is a science fiction writer and a National Endowment for the Arts Solo Performer Award winner. He was a nominee for the Nebula and the Sturgeon Award in previous years, and his first novel, Breakfast with the Ones You Love, was published by Random House. But his novel, or novella, Zen City, was published by Zero Books back in June, and since then it has sold very well and received a starred review in Publishers Weekly. Elliot Funtenschell, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Zen City. It takes place in a post-apocalyptic society. People, hopeful acolytes, live outside Zen City in rusted and broken down cars. They study Zen and hope to gain access to Zen and to Zen City. How did you come up with this allegory?
I was a Zen student for a long time back east in Rochester, New York. And boy, what a pressure cooker. I lived in a kind of Zen ghetto in a house full. Sometimes we called it the house of the lost boys. we were all these young Zen students, and we cleaned houses and did whatever we had to just to make enough money to support ourselves. Mm-hmm. But really what we wanted to do was spend 24/7 cross-legged facing a mop board, you know, trying to answer our koan. What is the sound of one hand, or what does a dog have Buddha nature, or whatever the question was. So that's one of the sources. I mean, whenever you get into a spiritual community, there's something beautiful and deep going on, but it's also people. So rubbing up against each other, all kinds of crazy things happen. And it was those crazy things and the crazy distortions of personalities that I was writing about in Zen City.
So now, when was this that you were in the Zen commune?
In the 1970s.
So you must have been like a toddler. And
no, I was in my 30s, late 20s and early 30s. Okay. Yeah. I'm 68 now.
Oh my gosh.
Venerable.
Yes, you are. Okay.
1 foot in the grave.
Well, yeah. So, so this was, you were a boomer, and this was had you gone through a hippie period, or what led you to Zen?
Oh, you bet I did. I was part of the great LSD culture. But I mean, even before that, I always had mystical aspirations. When I was a teenager, I used to read Madame Blavatsky and theosophists and mystical books. Once I got really excited because I went to a bookstore and found this book called The Sixth and Seventh Books of Moses. This, you know, just the way you're supposed to. You blow the dust off the cover and discover what it is in the back of the bookstore, and then you squirrel it home and pore over the diagrams and try to invoke Mephistopheles. And then you go back to the bookstore a week later and discover that there's stacks of it. It's come out in paperback. You can find it online nowadays for free. It's some kind of, I don't know if they were sincere mystics or just charlatans who put it together with all kinds of mystical diagrams and faux Hebrew and Greek formulas for invoking spirits with virgin parchment and dove's blood, which you can buy, by the way, from mystical supply houses nowadays.
And so did you try some of these incantations out?
Yes, I did, but had no results until much later I discovered psychedelics.
Oh, wow.
They actually do work in invoking spirits, but not the ones you would expect.
So, okay, yeah. So you're telling me the story about how you got from being an occult wizard, a wannabe occult wizard, to being a Zen Buddhist. So how did that follow? What was next?
Well, there was the psychedelic phase, but you know that has to dead end because you take a chemical, you go up and you go down, you go up and you go down. And I was very deeply unhappy anyway. I was just in the endless corridor, the hall of mirrors of my own mind, looking for a way out. And I happened to live across the street from the Beginner's Zendo, it was called, a part of this Zen center. And I would see these people in their brown robes sneaking in early every morning before dawn and then sneaking out again. And I eventually, questioning some of them, found out that it was this little sitting group. And I started sitting with them. And got the sense, just sitting quietly, listening to my own mind, the radio stations, the wildly wavering dials of my own internal radio station, I got the idea that this actually could lead to some understanding, just to listen, just to pay attention to what's going on. So I practiced that for many years.
What was it that was making you so unhappy in that moment? Were you seeking out a conventional life at all, or like a conventional career, or were you always just a spiritual seeker? I mean, were you having existential problems or personal problems, both?
You know, it's hard to single it out because, you know, all those things come in bunches. I happen to be the son of a psychotic father is one thing. He was in and out of institutions and we had a lot of wild scenes together. I've written about that, by the way, in short stories. I wrote a short story for the Ohio Review that was really all about my life with my psychotic father, whom I loved. But it's the difficulty of a love like that drives you into strange places. And it was out of one of those strange places that I sought Zen as a solution. And it did help a great deal. I did see things. I did find little holes in the sky through which you can touch stars. But it was a rocky ride.
Now, so what did he do? I mean, as a career.
What a story. My father was born to a family of bakers. My uncle's a baker, my grandfather, my aunt, all bakers. And my father developed, ready for this one, an allergy to flour. Right. So he tried everything. Nothing worked. And then he became a machinist. He trained at night school and became a machinist, worked in factories, and got that classic ailment that machinists get. He got a bad back. So he was just dogged by bad luck.
Okay. When you reached out for Zen, you were already out of the house, but you're just dealing with the ramifications an unhappy childhood.
I was. And I mean, quite independently of that unhappy childhood, I just have always had one of those satellite kinds of minds that goes round and round the earth without ever quite landing. I just was dedicated to fantastic visions of the way I should be, of the way the world was. And I was uncertain about the boundaries of who and what I was, which sounds like a horrible thing, but actually, I believe that's been my greatest gift. That doubt, that wondering about the boundaries of self has really been the best thing in my life, and it's what I've made my career out of as a writer and a performer.
Well, your generation is sort of famous for having difficulty with that, right? I mean,
I think that's true. An identifiable segment of my generation for sure.
You guys were the ones who had to go off and find yourself.
Right.
But I think that's something actually that every generation deals with. That's what coming of age is all about, is trying to figure out who you are and what you're going to be. So how did Zen help you? Maybe I'm asking this really for myself. Like, could Zen help someone like me?
One way of putting the whole project of Zen is to stay awake even when you're gone, when your body's gone, to stay awake even when the peripheries of yourself are evaporating. And you know, that happens all the time. People have this idea that they're this fixed thing that has their name, and that that as you go through the day, that tag stays like pinned to your ear or something. But if you really examine your experience moment for moment, it isn't like that at all. There, most of the time, you have no idea that you're even a human being. You have no idea that you have two arms and two legs. I mean, whenever you stop and look for them, yes, there they are. But all that time that you're not looking for them, you might be an amoeba. You might be the sun. You might be a cubic foot of fog over the Los Angeles freeway. And it's staying awake to all those kinds of experiences that's really so illuminating.
The student is really being asked to be absolutely genuine. If I said to you, now don't be self-conscious. I want you to be perfectly sincere. And as a matter of fact, I'm a mind reader. And I know whether you're being sincere or not. I can see right down to that last little wiggly guzzle in the back of your mind. And if you think I can, you see, I'm putting you in a double bind. I'm commanding you to be genuine. How can you possibly do that on command? Especially when the person you're confronted with is a father figure, an authority figure. And in Japan, the sensei, the teacher, is even a more authoritative figure than one's father, which is saying a lot. But you are being asked in the presence of this tiger to be completely spontaneous. Or it isn't put in that way, you see, though. I mean, I'm describing this from the standpoint of a psychologist observing what's going on here. No, the thing you've got to do is you've got to hear the sound of one hand. And as your answers become more and more rejected, you get more and more desperate. And there is built up the state that is called the great doubt. The students do everything, you know. They've read all the old Zen stories, and they come in with the pieces of rock and wood, and they try and hit the teacher. They do everything they get. And nothing will do. I remember I had a friend studying in Kyoto, and on the way to the master's quarters, you pass through a lovely garden with a pool, and he saw a bullfrog in the garden. And he grabbed this bullfrog. They're very tame in Japan. Nobody eats them. He put it in the sleeve of his kimono. And when he got in to give an answer to his koan, he produced the bullfrog. And the master shook his head and said, mm-mm, too intellectual.
The crazy move in Zen City is to make enlightenment, which is seems like a really abstract thing, into a place. It's a city. And instead of people trying to achieve enlightenment the way folks do at these spiritual centers nowadays, in this future world, to achieve enlightenment means to get into this city. The standard way of doing it is to go through customs or control, and they screen you. They have a way of screening your soul to see if it's clear enough to deserve to be beamed into the city. But you know, people sit, they do, you know, what we call zazen, just still sitting meditation, trying to achieve this in this world. And sometimes they keep going to control and keep getting rejected. And finally, a bunch of these characters in the book Zen City decide that they're going to sneak into Zen City, and they find a system of caves and lost rivers underground that they can follow to get to the field where Zen City is established, this actual place. And the book is mostly about the adventures that they have underground, like Alice's adventures underground, I guess.
You think of enlightenment as a stripping away of ambition. But in your novel, of course, it isn't that at all.
Right. You know, and that's the same contradiction that you encounter in real life in these Zen centers. I mean, for example, at the Rochester Zen Center, there they practiced a kind of, well, it was really a kind of Rinzai Zen, although that's not quite what they called it. People were working on koans, and the people working on koans were, you can't imagine how ardent they were. They would do a practice called voicing the koan, sometimes in these week-long retreats, where, for example, if you're working on the koan called mu, people would be shouting mu, shouting that Japanese word until the walls shook. You could hear it blocks and blocks away. People were desperate to pass through the koan. Periodically, a bell would ring, and people would run upstairs from the zendo into the teacher's little room. Philip Kaplow was the teacher there, a kind of famous guy in Zen circles. And you would sit before the teacher, and he would ask you testing questions like, you're in a burning room. There are no windows and doors. How do you get out? Or you have a goose in the bottle. Can you get the goose out of the bottle without breaking it? Just the impossible questions. Can you jump inside an incense holder? What would that be like? And you have to have an answer for them, not only in words, but in gestures. You have to become the answer, or else he rings the little bell again. You go back down to the meditation hall and keep sitting until you do have an answer. Some people take years and years to find the answer to one of these koans, one of these questions. And what happens then?
Sounds like you had your own personal koan.
I worked on the famous koan mu, which is somebody asked. I mean, according to the Buddhist sutras, as most people know one way or another, everybody and everything has this thing called Buddha nature, this absolute nature. And the story goes that somebody asked Joshu, this famous Zen guy, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu said, no. Which in Japanese is muh. And Zen students have been riddling over that one for all these years. And that's the koan that I worked on. What the hell did he mean by saying no? Of course a dog has a Buddha nature. Why did he say it doesn't have a Buddha nature?
And it's not because he thought that only self-conscious beings could have a Buddha nature, and that you had to be a human in order to achieve Buddha nature.
No, a dog absolutely has a Buddha nature. I worked on that for 5 or 6 years before the teacher said, "Okay, now you can work on something else."
Well, what was your answer?
It can't be Skyped.
It's not like he said no because he was in a bad mood that day.
No.
Because he didn't want to be asked any more questions.
You know, I mean, one way of going at it is to say, I mean, Joshua was trying to get the person who asked him to understand it on his own, because there's no way of conveying it through, a Wikipedia entry. The guy was asking him, what's it all about? What am I all about? Why should I be alive rather than dead? And Joshua was saying, was kind of whacking him into figuring it out for himself.
Okay, well, that's another good question. Forget the dog. Why should I be alive rather than dead? Or put it a different way, why is there anything rather than nothing? Why is there something rather than nothing?
Right.
Come on,
right.
Elliot.
Well, but come on, Elliot.
Help me out here.
Hey.
These are problems, man.
You ask too much of me.
Okay, but seriously, you know, one thing about Zen Buddhism that kind of frustrates me is that, I like Western philosophy.
Yes.
And so, like, when you get a question like, does dog have Buddha nature in Western philosophy, what you say is, well, what do you mean by Buddha nature?
Right.
What is Buddha nature?
Yeah.
And then you spend days and days or weeks and weeks or months and months or a whole lifetime writing about, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
Just what is nature before you even get to Buddha nature.
Right.
And so you get a question like, why is there something rather than nothing? You try to answer it with real, like, with linear argumentation and logic.
Yes.
And that's my preferred approach to this.
Yeah, but suppose someone comes up to you and says, do you really love me? That's not a question you can answer by scholarship.
Well, depends on who they are. Who would this be?
But that's the kind of question, do you really love me? That's the kind of question that what is mu is. It's an existential question, a question that forces you to answer it with your life, not just with words.
Okay, all right. So let me see if I'm gonna put on a toga and I'll be Western philosophy.
Okay.
Okay. And you can put on, I guess.
Take off all my clothes and I'll be Eastern philosophy.
Okay, that's good. All right, don't take off. Whatever, it's on Skype and the video isn't on. So whatever you want to do. but okay, here's the thing. Okay, so one of my colleagues, one of my contemporaries, one of my peers at the Zen Center comes up to me and says, do you love me, brother? And I need to answer that. Now, if I'm a Western philosopher who's at the wrong location, I might say, what do we mean by love? Are you asking me, will I support you in some political maneuver within this Zen center? Well, that depends on what it is. Are you asking me, for a romance? Well, that might depend on a lot of different factors as well. So we need to get to what you're really asking here, because asking me, do you love me, has different meanings in different contexts.
Right.
And you know, if you're like my wife, then I'm just going to say yes, right? Because that's my obligation.
Of course.
And you know, probably because it's mostly true most of the time. I feel like you ask questions like that have a lot of cultural force behind them. You know, they have maybe traditions behind them, which then come with feelings. And then you can say this question isn't like a question that can be answered logically through argumentation because it's something different. But really what's going on is that it's freighted with like cultural and emotional significance, sometimes even economic obligation. So, you know, do you love me in the context of a marriage can mean a whole bunch of shit, and it's not not only romantic and beautiful, but also, you know, quite pragmatic. And of course, the truth is there are limits to how logical you can be in that instance and still maintain the marriage, right? You can't just every time you're asked that question, if you say, "Well, what do you mean?" You're going to be in a world of hurt. But nonetheless, the reality is that these things do have a logic behind them. Mm-hmm. They just aren't always expressible for variety of real-world practical reasons.
You know, in Zen City, I have a scene where this guy, Boboshin, a Japanese monk, comes into this kind of Zen settlement of cars that have been stuck in an intersection for generations, so people live in them, like the Econoline Van Hotel. There's Claire, this one zealous woman, is sitting in a car with Boboshin Roshi, and they're having a conversation about these people who are rumored to have taken off into the caves to find Zen City, enlightenment. Their conversation kind of goes, they go past one another in the conversation. She keeps thinking that he's coming on to her, and he keeps trying to correct her. But eventually he realizes that he is attracted to her. And so there's kind of a crazy love scene in the front seat of a Ford Econoline van between Boboshin Roshi and Claire.
So Zen turns out to be a good way to get laid?
Exactly. Yes, that's true. but we always knew that. You know, nothing so sexy as authority, and nothing so authoritative as spiritual authority.
There does come a critical point of total desperation. And when the student reaches that point, the teacher really starts encouraging him. He says, "Now, come on, you're getting warm. But you must die, be ready to die for this. You must, students have even been put under into the position that if they don't get it in so many days, they're going to commit suicide." And they have to stimulate this intense period, a thing called obsession. Don't confuse the word session with the English session. Session means studying or observation of the shin, the heart, the mind, the heart-mind. And at this time, they only sleep 4 hours a night. And they meditate solidly all through the day. They go for the Sanzen interview twice a day, every one of them. And it's a tremendous workout and will last about 5 days, 5 or 6 days. And in that period, the pressure is really on. Everybody is worked into a pitch of this kind of psychic fury that they have to get this thing answered. There's a man in Japan today who has a 5 day Zen system, and he practically guarantees that you will have Satori in his 5 days. I've just got a book about it written by a Britisher. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. Well, I had someone I knew of who was over studying Zen on a Fulbright grant, and the grant was winding up, and he still hadn't got the sound of one hand. He said to the master, "Look, a grant's running out and I can't stay here. And I've just got to get this thing." So just the day before he left, he suddenly realized that there was nothing to realize. And that was it. You know, here he had spent his whole life thinking that there's something deficient in me. See, there's something wrong. Something I ought to find out to get this problem of life cleaned up. Well, you know what you do. Rinzai, the old Chinese master, said, "Zen teaching is like using an empty fist to deceive a child. Or like trying to stop a child crying by giving it a yellow leaf. See, the child wants gold. And so you give it an autumn leaf and say, 'Dear darling, there's some gold. Be all right.' Or with your closed fist, you say, 'What have I got here?' The child comes and tries to see and pull your fingers open. Then you hide it behind your back and under your leg and behind the chair. child gets absolutely fascinated. The longer you keep this up, the more the child is sure there's something real goody inside the hand. And then at the end, pssst, nothing. And that's Zen.
Tell me a little bit about your experience inside the city. How long were you at the Zen Center?
Oh, gee, I don't know, 6 or 7 years in various forms. I was there for 5 or 6 years. I got married there, and we stayed there. And then we moved to another place, to a different Zen center. The reason I first came to California was to be at a Zen center here up on Sonoma Mountain.
So what is enlightenment within a Zen center? What happens to you when you reach enlightenment? Is that something that is ever officially recognized?
Well, that's the crazy thing about it. There is official recognition, even though in various ways it's denied. It's a social phenomenon as well as a spiritual or psychological phenomenon because people are recognized. They get different clothing. They get a sort of Buddhist bib that they wear so that whenever anyone sees them, they see, here's someone who has successfully answered their koan. And that causes all kinds of social ripples. You get status, social status from this spiritual achievement.
Do you get a position of authority within the institution other than just social status? I mean, do you become a priest or something like that?
People have it as a career in the sense that they're supported by the Zen community, the same as monks in the Catholic Church.
So they're all living there. It's all supported by the Zen community. And you can get higher rank within the institution, but that doesn't come with an advancement in pay. But it does mean that you have more authority over other people.
Yes.
In the Zen center.
Yeah, in some sense, yeah. Yeah, people,
So it's sort of like the military.
Yeah, there's a pecking order, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference being, of course, that at any time anyone can just turn around and leave.
Right, which is what you eventually did?
Yes.
So did you ever get to the point where you were, like, completely recognized as an enlightened soul?
At the Zen Center where I first practiced, when you got to a certain point, when you answered a certain set of koans, you received what's called a raksu, a ceremonial garb. And I did receive that ceremonial garb.
And how did that make you feel?
It made me feel like $1 million. It made me feel like a hotshot. It made me feel like I was on top of the world for a year and a half anyway.
That's a good long run.
Yeah.
That feeling, you know, because I remember when I got my first short story published.
Yeah.
I felt really good for almost a whole week.
Oh, man. That's terrible. It's like a narcotic, you know. You build up a resistance. You got more and more and more.
And that buzz has so little to do with what you're supposedly really trying to do.
Right. Yeah.
Did you feel at the time when you got your bib that there was a contradiction in the way you were feeling and what you were being recognized for?
It took me a long time to become aware of that. You know, I mean, you work so hard, really deeply hard to do something, to get through this riddle, to get through something in yourself. And then when there's some sign of having made progress, it's hard to be reasonable about it. It's hard to remember what it's really about. And the only way I was finally reminded was by being humiliated again and again, being made to confront myself quite unwillingly, you know, to see what a schmuck I was being, how full of myself I was. It's, you know, there's even a name for it in Zen. It's called Zen sickness.
And how does that usually manifest?
Well, self-adoration, or by thinking that you know something.
And that's the whole point of Zen, is that you don't, right?
That's one way of putting it, yes.
It's odd. I mean, the problem here is, I think, I mean, I don't know much about Zen, but I think in general the problem with spirituality in human beings is that we try to have spirituality to do two things that can't be separated from each other, really, but at the same time don't actually match up very well. So in other words, we try to have our spirituality both give us the meaning of our life or help us understand our life and tell us, organize us and help us socially in a society.
Right, yeah.
And those two things can't really be separated out. Your meanings, the meanings of your life, you know, the norms, the ideas, and the culture are going to influence how the things are organized.
Right, yeah.
But
it's a mess.
But the problem is once you go down to this road of really trying to figure out the meaning of life, the answers you're going to get are going to be so abstract and intricate and recursive and strange that they don't really fit any normative set.
Well, you know, I don't think that's true. You do find out practical things. You find out things that you can't articulate very well, things about ways of living. It's like, you know, I mean, when you learn how to ride a bicycle, for heaven's sake, that's not some kind of discursive knowledge. And the knowledge of how to ride a bicycle is more like the knowledge that you can acquire through Zen practice.
The way they teach kids these days to ride bikes is they have these little, like, kick bikes. They don't even have pedals. What you do is you kind of sit on the seat like he is right now, and then you push with your feet. And as you do that, the bike gets some momentum, and that's important because that gives you balance. And then as it feels stable, go ahead and kick a little bit, Brian, and then pick your feet up. See how he can pick his feet up like that? He's basically riding a bike. I mean, he's not pedaling or anything, but he's getting a feel for the balance. And see, now if you tried to turn, Brian, and you were going to fall, you could easily put your feet down. So he really doesn't need to fall at all. Of course, he has his helmet on. Why don't you do a turn?
Do you want to read a little bit from your book? That maybe will be how we close out the podcast. Do you have a section you like to read from?
Sure. Here's a sort of description of the way the city appears to Suds and Virya, two characters who sneak out toward it. It looked like a quarter-mile-high cube of flesh, cavernous as if worm-eaten, riddled with flashing pin lights, whole sections glowing or dimming, glistening with moisture, then drying and becoming dull as juice, slicked a different section, electric to the touch, pulsing erratically with accumulations of tiny erratic bursts, waves of sound like swept rain, like radio static scanning for a station. Suds touched the city here and there as he walked its perimeter, and images streamed into him like blood through an IV, corpses in drawers, a clump of worms in a bait can, maggot-infested droppings, one's own feces found teeming and tunneled with gleaming worms, ghoulish horrors, and at the same time interloping visions of a gone century, businessmen's lunch at a buzzing Manhattan diner, commuter trains to Tokyo replacing red blood cells in a sleeper's arteries, the heart a roundhouse for the intercity locals, caffeine, television roulette, a big city welfare building cum VD clinic, cum stock exchange, wild men leaping like popcorn from sizzling oil to bid on penny stocks, knocking against the steamy Pyrex lid, leaving drippy grease marks. You take it off the burner, remove the lid, and a dozen more kernels explode across the room. Shivering and grabbing at the air, Sud skidded backwards on his buttocks. Amitabha, this heap is the city. It smells like manure. It looks like a big hemorrhoid.
Hey, I'm really glad that we published your book. It's doing great. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, vice versa.